Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com. If we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Although these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremedyisinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. So there are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of what you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Martin, I want to thank you for that wonderful disclaimer. Ladies and gentlemen, these disclaimers are very important. I've been doing these lengthy disclaimers for coming up to almost 30 years, and in that time, not once have I ever received a communication from any prosecutor or investigator from the state inquiring about practicing law without a license. So thank you for bearing through it. Now, we have some first-time callers here tonight, and you may not know this, but I'll ask you for your first name. I'll tie it to your phone number. I don't need to your last name. Don't want that on the open call, but just your first name. And then I'll be able to attach it to this phone number that I see you calling in from. And should I ever have someone from the state contact me and say, well, we have a issue here where you're being charged with practicing law without a license, and I'm going to say, well, you know, you're going to have somebody come forward that said that they were on the call. Bingo. I've got a record of everything that was on the call. So if we may start with real quickly with Raleigh, North Carolina, ending in 9255. First name only, please.
John.
Well, thank you, John. Appreciate you. How'd you hear about us?
From a friend.
Well, I'm glad, John, you have a friend. That's comforting. That's good to know. I have a friend, too, but it's an imaginary friend, and you know how that goes, I guess. I don't know. Next is also Greensboro, North Carolina, ending in 5751, if I may have just your first name only.
Valerie and Francine and Jim referred me and John.
Okay. Thank you, Miss Valerie. I appreciate that. One moment. And lastly, no, two more. Newport, California. Where'd you go? You were here. Just dropped off. Okay, how about Memphis, Tennessee? First name only, please, ending in 1820. Memphis, Tennessee, ending in 1820. May I have your first name only, please? Or not. Okay. All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate you all. I have great news tonight. We're going to have a special guest, a special speaker. His name is John, and John is the point of the spear, the team leader, if you would, for the team. And he will be joining us at the bottom of the hour. So while we're going to be waiting on that, his arrival, I want to cover some basic ground with everyone. If you've been on these calls before, you're going to hear some things repeated, and that's okay because repetition kind of sinks things in. In addressing matters of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of our federal Constitution, President Madison said in the Federalist Papers, number 39, and I quote, this is January 26, 1788, published, "Its jurisdiction extends to certain enumerated objects only and leaves to the several states a residuary and inviolable sovereignty over all other objects." And it was just 85 years later, nearly immediately following our Civil War, in United States versus Anthony, 24 Fed 829, this is 1873, quote, "The term resident and citizen of the United States is distinguished from, meaning different, a citizen of one of the several states, and that the former is a special class of citizen created by the Congress," end quote. So, if Congress decides that they want to prohibit federal citizens from using a particular brand of toothpaste or whatever, or if they require them to be vaccinated, federal courts will think that they are authorized to enter that municipal law, which is really only within the jurisdiction of the United States, that they may enter it into all 50 states of the Union. Not so. Then we take off to 1901. This is called the Bidwell decision, where Supreme Court Justice John Marshall Harlan predicted what the fallout was from what we just talked about in those two court cases. He said that the idea prevails with some, indeed it has found expression in arguments at the bar, that we have in this country substantially two national governments, one to be maintained under the Constitution with all its restrictions, the other to be maintained by the Congress outside and independently of that instrument, and get this part, by exercising such powers as other nations of the earth are accustomed to. It continues, "I take leave to say that if the principles thus announced should ever receive the sanction of a majority of this court, a radical and mischievous change in our system of government will result. We will, in that event, pass from the era of constitutional liberty, guarded and protected by a written constitution, into an era of legislative absolutism, and it will be an evil day for American liberty if the theory of government outside the supreme law of the land finds lodgment in our constitutional jurisprudence. No higher duty rests upon this court than to exert its full authority to prevent all violations of the principles of this Constitution." This was Downs versus Bidwell, 182 U.S. 244. So how did that all pan out? What do we have to show for it? Well, what we have out of the Bidwell decision, and again in 1945 in the Hooven decision, where the question of what is the United States, define the United States, and this ended up in Black's Law Dictionary, 4th edition, 5th and 6th edition. It was not published in the 7th edition forward. I think we're in edition 10 or 12 now. I don't even bother with them. I've got my collection of Black's Law 4th, and actually a copy of the 1st I was able to put together as well. But this is what it all amounts to. The term United States. If somebody asks you, are you standing on United States land? Or if they ask you, are you a United States person or people or whatever? There are three definitions. Three. And each one is as far removed from the other as you could possibly get. So I'm going to read them to you and then comment on it. Quote, "It may be merely the name of a sovereign occupying the position analogous to that of other sovereigns in the family of nations." That's the first definition. Now, this reference is referring to we the people. In fact, quoting Scott versus Sanford, who were at the time of the adoption of the Constitution recognized as citizens in the several states. Let me interject here. Remember, before the Constitution, 6 years before that was the Articles of Confederation. The whole thing started with the Articles of Confederation. 6 years later, when they met in Philadelphia, the Articles of Confederation was amended and renamed. It was never canceled out. Okay? It was amended and renamed. Amendment by like 90% of it was changed. But it was amended as opposed to made void and then something new come in. So everything that the Constitution has is built upon the Articles of Confederation. And where it says right here, and I'm going to repeat this part, at the time of the adoption of the Constitution, recognized as citizens in the several states. So those are the citizens of the several states that came into being through the translation from being colonists to state citizens for the, under the Articles of Confederation. Continuing, became also citizens of this new political body, but none other. It was formed by them and for them and their posterity and for no one else. I can trace my genealogy, well, actually beyond 1750, but for purposes of this document here, I have a grandfather, Nathaniel, eight times removed, that's listed in the Massachusetts militia rolls in 1770s and 80s. He was also listed in the Massachusetts militia rolls for fighting the War of 1812, as well as the war with Britain. So I have someone in my bloodline that King George III, through his emissaries, referred to as his peer. So that makes me one of the sovereigns, the name of a sovereign, Michael Edward, of a sovereign occupying the position analogous to other sovereigns in the family of nations. You may very well also share that heritage, that genealogy. And if so, the first definition applies to you. Then the second definition. This is where the government commits fraud against everybody. And it's fraud not because what they did was they withheld information from you. That's the fraud. It wasn't fraud that you volunteered into it. You have involuntary servitude under the 13th Amendment. This is where you're hijacked, kidnapped, shanghaied, whatever, and you're forced to labor somewhere. But there's such a thing as voluntary servitude. And that's precisely, and nobody explains it to you, but that's precisely what happened when you agreed to fill out an SS-5 form, or your parents did for you, and you continue throughout your life going to the government, the federal government, asking for permission to do something, asking for permission to go hunt, to go fish, to get behind the wheel of a car and go somewhere, get married, practice healing arts, and so forth. You had to ask them for permission for everything. And in the process of them granting you permission, besides taking your money, they controlled exactly how, where, when you might exercise these privileges. So number two definition is, it may designate the territory, not the states, the territory over which the sovereignty of the United States extends. What is that? Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, 10 miles within the seat of power, all territories, possessions, and enclaves. These persons are United States citizens. Reference the 14th Amendment with a democratic form of government, a democracy. Have you ever heard it said, we must make this world safe for democracy? Well, that's who you are. And as long as you have a Social Security number, as long as you've not corrected your status, this is where you'll stay. So does that mean that they can force you to be vaccinated? Well, let me ask you this. If you were a rancher and equine encephalitis was coming around, could you vaccinate your horses, your animals, just because you want to protect them against this encephalitis, this equine encephalitis? Of course you could. If you were a cattle rancher and the mad cow disease was coming through, you know, in the neighborhood, could you vaccinate your cattle? Absolutely. So you being property of the United States, you're their chattel, they can vaccinate you, and that's the end of it. Or let's go to the third definition. And this is in all likelihood, unless you share that genealogy that I have, this is probably where you sit. It may be the collective names of the states, which are united by and under the Constitution. Now, these people are quoting the IRS's W-8-BEN form, an older form. They no longer offer this form, but if you have a copy of it, you can use it, where it refers to these people as Union State citizens within a guaranteed Republican form of government. So when the word United States is bantered around, you don't just say, yes, I'm a United States citizen, or yes, I'm on United States land. No. You say, I would say, well, you'd have to stipulate for me which definition you are employing that I may know and understand so that I may answer your question. And, of course, they never will do that. So let's look at some court cases that have been causing a lot of people to turn their head a little sideways and wrinkle their nose. So let's look at these court cases. Remember, we already talked about U.S. versus Anthony, quote, the term resident and citizen of the United States is distinguished from, meaning different, from a citizen of one of the several states, and that the former is a special class of citizen created by Congress. Now, Maxwell versus Dow, 20 SCR 448 at page 455, it says, quote, the privileges, it didn't say the rights, it says the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States do not necessarily include all the rights protected by the first 8 amendments to the federal Constitution against the powers of the federal government. Well, that's going to tell you something there. U.S. versus Valentine, 288 F. Sup, 957, quote, the only absolute and unqualified right, only the singular right, it's not the Bill of Rights, that's 10 or more, it's the only singular right of a United States citizen is to residence within the territorial boundaries of the United States. Now, if you're sitting here in Florida or maybe in Texas, California, wherever you are, is that a state or a territory? Well, that depends. Let's say you're in California. If the title is California State, then California would be one of the several states of the Union. But if the title is State of California, well, my friend, that's a territory of the United States under the Buck Act of 1940. Wheeling Steel Corporation versus Fox, quote, therefore, the U.S. citizen, open bracket, citizens of the District of Columbia, close bracket, residing in one of the states of the Union, are classified as property and franchises of the federal government as an individual entity. I asked you earlier, could you be forced to be vaccinated? Well, if you're definition number 3 United States citizen, yep, that's for sure. Hendricks versus Maryland, SC Reporters, 610 through 625. Quote, a U.S. citizen upon leaving the District of Columbia becomes involved in interstate commerce as a resident and does not have the common law rights, blah, 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 of a citizen of one of the several states. So it's saying that if you're definition number 2, you don't have common law rights. What are the common law rights? The Bill of Rights, for one thing. That's in your face. But really, anything from the Articles of Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, the Northwest Ordinance, a Constitution for the United States of America, not of the United States. You're going to hear that word sometime, too. And that's strictly where the United States, through the Congress assemble, hijacked our Constitution and called it their own. City of Dallas versus Mitchell. The rights of the individuals are restricted only to the extent that they have been, catch this, voluntarily surrendered by the citizenship of the agencies of government. Do you understand that the various alphabet agencies, which exist only for the pleasure of the United States government, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17, that when you exercise a use of them, that you are identifying yourself and having surrendered your citizenship because you've used that agency to the federal government. In Wadley versus Newell, Circuit Court, North District of California, quote, civil rights under the 14th Amendment are for federal citizens and not state citizens. Federal citizens, as parents, have no right to the custody of their infant children except subject to the paramount right of the state. And it goes on and on. We've got several of these. I want to check real quick to see if John has joined us here yet. Let me refresh. No, he hasn't shown yet, so I'll continue. Give me one moment to go back to that. All right. So those are just some very stark contrasts between one class of United States citizen and another class of United States citizen. And so as not to ever give the opportunity to convolute the which one that you may be in relationship to the one asking you the question, we prefer to use the words Union State Citizen or American National, because both the Union State Citizen and American National appear on United States government documents. And if you don't think this is important, if any of you have IRS challenges, in U.S. versus Slater, 545 Fed Sup, this is 1982. It's a very recent case. Quote, unless the defendant can prove he is not a citizen of the United States, the IRS has the right to inquire and determine a tax liability, end quote. If there's no reason, if there's any reason that you need to have your status corrected, it's that right there. Although for myself personally, I'd like to have on my tombstone, here lies a free man, something to that effect. Now, the people have asked, many people have asked, what about the fact that if I do this, you know, am I going to be giving up, you know, my Social Security and Medicaid, Medicare, whatever? And the answer is no. Why? Well, let's look at two more cases. Houston versus Moore. Every citizen of a state owes a double allegiance. He enjoys the protections and participates in the government of both the state and the United States, end quote. And then in Moore versus Illinois, 55 U.S. 13 and 20, quote, every citizen of the United States is also a citizen of a territory or a state. He may be said to owe allegiance to two sovereigns and may be liable to punishment for an infraction of the laws of either. Now, that sounds scary, but let's clear it up in United States versus Cruikshank. This is 92 U.S. 542. It is the natural consequence of a citizenship which owes allegiance to two sovereignties. We just talked about them in Moore versus Illinois and in Houston versus Moore, and claims protection from both. Let's do that again. It is the natural consequence of a citizenship which owes allegiance to two sovereignties and claims protection from both. He owes allegiance, if you would, to two departments, so to speak, and within their respective spheres, that's jurisdiction, must pay the penalty which each exacts for disobedience of its laws. In return, he can demand the protection from each within its own jurisdiction. Again, what can be more plain to exhort you to correct your status? Because you are listed by the United States State Department right now as number two, a citizen of the United States. And you have no rights, you have only privileges. And you have reinforced that with your activity all your life by going to them for permission for anything, getting a license, and then being controlled by that license on how you behave with whatever you ask for permission for. But they're only within their own spheres, their own jurisdiction. So the question is, am I standing on United States land when you charged me with this federal crime, yes or no? No, I'm on land of one of the several states of the Union. I'm not on territory. I'm not in one of its possessions or its enclaves. I'm not in Washington, D.C. I'm here in Florida. Leave me alone. And again, that's the land. What about the person? Well, I'm not a person in law. I'm one of the people. And I'm not a United States citizen under the second definition. If push comes to shove, let's identify the third definition and go away. So these are the things that make it so incredibly important. So incredibly important. And then the last court case that I want to share with you is Cross versus Board of Supervisors, because people will say, well, you know, I just don't want the hassle. I got a driver's license, you know, and I just don't want the hassle. So in it wasn't Cross versus Board of Supervisors. This is Cargill Company versus State of Minnesota. And I quote, the acceptance of a license in whatever form, doctor's license, whatever, will not impose upon the licensee an obligation to respect or to comply with any provision of the statute or with the regulations prescribed that are repugnant to the Constitution of the United States. So that right there shows you that your participation with regards to, you know, driving with a driver's license, et cetera. But if you have corrected your status, you do have an identification card from the State Department of the United States. When that blue light special goes on in your rearview mirror and the officer walks up, you roll your window down, he's asking for your driver's license, proof of insurance and registration, you hand him what? Your ID card from the State Department of the United States. What's this? Please, officer, this is what I'm to give you. Take it to your car and run your magnetic strip, please. So he takes it to the car, runs the magnetic strip, up pops your picture and your ID for him, and it says, it's red flagged. Red flag? Is this a terrorist? No, could be. It's red flagged. Do not investigate. Do not detain. Release immediately. Lifetime concealed carry weapons permit. Wow. So, these are all your reasons and motivation, but most importantly, simply, is the fact that it has been agreed now, and perhaps Brother John is going to talk about this tonight, why it is so incredibly important that you have your status changed if for any reason you need the team to avail themselves to you. John, I see you're there. Welcome. I cannot hear you, John.
Hold on. Let's see.
It's like you're talking through a wire radio or something.
Hold on.
There you go.
Okay, can you hear me?
Welcome back.
Can you hear me a little better now?
Much better.
Can you hear me now?
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, my humble apologies. So how's everybody doing tonight?
They're doing well. Everybody's muted. That we do this, and we get to a point
where
you've given a monologue to a degree, then we'll have them raise their hands and let you talk to them.
Okay.
So just share with us, if you would, the importance for you with regards to correcting the status, and maybe share what else that you might be able to accomplish and work for them.
Well, your status has on paper, there are people that have goals and agendas that are more personal than most of the people that we would like to believe serve in public office, that define social civic-minded citizens that would be there to serve the public trust. These individuals have more of a desire to capitalize, if you will, on anything that they can, your person being one of them. There's been discussions that go back to the turn of the last century, just where there were some meetings at a place called Jekyll Island, quite a pleasant resort on the East Coast, and they decided that these individuals who have money and assets invested from and have been investing assets in government since before the time of Christ, and they would loan money to the leaders and the aristocracy and the administrators of the different governments. And originally, what they did was they the Roman government, they loaned the Emperor of Rome money so that he could increase his lifestyle. And after he became drunk on that and had himself quite a debt, every once in a while they would ask for a favor in lieu of him paying his debt. And that debt became kind of a pair of golden handcuffs or a noose around his neck or his feet, because eventually his lifestyle was such that he was drunk on the pleasantness of it, and he didn't want to give it up, so he began to grant these folks favors. They next went to the King of Spain, and similar overtures, except that all of a sudden, when Spain found itself in debt to Rome, they said, "Hold on, don't worry about it. You know, they have a debt to us. We'll take care of that for you, and you, et cetera, et cetera. We'll write off some of your debt to us." And what happens is that now, slowly, without any of the exchanging of actual currency that had any monetary denotation or intrinsic value, they began to make ledger entries and began to manage finances. And as this began to go through later on into Prussia and England and the Norwegian countries, they embedded themselves very, very well. Well, at one point there was this country that seemed to be without fetter from any of their control and financially. And so to that end, they decided that they needed to do something about it. And in the midst of that, they needed help from a couple of other nations. And they took a young gentleman, a Mr. Churchill, aside and explained to him what they would do. And Mr. Churchill didn't realize that these folks were funding both sides of the war that was about to come, the First World War. And they explained to him how it would be handled and eventually how it would be wrapped up and closed. And they explained also that they were going to this other country that seemed to be without betterment, they were going to precipitate a bankruptcy by propping up their stock market to the point where it was no longer sustainable if they pulled out just the right amount of cash. And they even identified the date that they were going to do it. And coincidentally, on that particular date, we even had individuals jumping off of buildings and during the stock market crash of 1929. And in 1933, we filed bankruptcy. This country filed bankruptcy in world court, and they at least they try to precipitate that the country filed bankruptcy. They don't like to make that popular, but as part of the they set up a corporation to do business for the aggregate, for the national man and the national government, and the corporation has a constitution that mirrors the constitution for the aggregate. What happens is that individuals are now with the corporation, they began to identify each and every individual and collateralize that individual against this quote unquote this bankruptcy and this national debt. Those of you who are older than 23 may remember that our grandparents, when you went to the polling place, there were two sets of ballots. There was one for residents, and then there was one for landowners. And as bad as that sounds, it almost sounds like feudal English, feudal law. Well, it kind of was. The landowners voted for representatives only, or excuse me, the residents voted for representatives only, but the landowners voted for both senators and representatives. And at this juncture, back in the 1800s, this is the process all the way up to the early 1900s that valid senators and electors and representatives and electors were placed in office. Well, in lieu of the 1933 bankruptcy, the last year that they had a valid election was 1932. So the last valid duly elected electors or representative or senators left office in 1938. After this, they were, the corporation was now doing business for the aggregate. This is part of the reason that some things don't seem to match with the government. Now, originally back, as you look back, and there are many, many documents that are obligatory for the U.S. government. And among these, they go back beyond the Constitution, even to the Declaration of Independence, where it states, we hold these truths to be self-evident that individuals are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these, and it says among these, indicating that, first of all, they're talking about an intelligent designer, a creator, a godlike entity. However you want to refer to them, space aliens, E.T., Yahweh, Jesus, you know, extraterrestrials or whatever, this entity, this intelligent designer that made this, not just this third rock from the sun that we call planet Earth that we live on, but the whole universe, is out there. And we as a nation recognize that. And that we're endowed by our creator with certain inalienable rights. And it says among these, indicating that there's these few are from a much larger pool of rights. Among these are the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And you can just, and it says, and to secure those rights, governments are instituted among men by the governed. Governments are instituted among men by the government. So when we come to Abraham Lincoln at the Gettysburg Address, when he uses the term, this is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, we find, you know, him speaking, not referring directly to the Declaration of Independence. Now, when the government, when someone doesn't have time, doesn't have skill sets, they doesn't feel safe, doesn't have the capacities, or just isn't able to, they hire help. And among that, you know, those, you know, we hire longshoremen, U.S. forestry workers, Department of Transportation, highway safety people, you know, police officers, sanitation district, governors, presidents, judges, sheriffs. Oh, by the way, those last four, they're not just hired help, they're just temp help, okay? But nonetheless, they're hired help. They're not sovereign, they're God. And those inalienable rights that were reserved for the people were never, ever, ever surrendered or abdicated to the hired help. We confer to them, like the sheriff, because he's elected, we confer him the authority of arrest. The citizens have an inalienable right to make an arrest. And those rights were never surrendered or abdicated to the hired help. sometimes police officers say, well, hey, you know, you can't do that. You know, you can't pay, that's my job. Excuse me, you're just the hired help. The sheriff is the highest authority in any local jurisdiction. The president, he's not sovereign. He's not God. This one that's currently, you know, sometimes then man makes God in their own image. There's some misconstructions there. There may be more than just some minor misconstructions there, but all these people are there to serve us. Now, there are these other folks that have been doing the money for many, many years that have gotten to the place where, using the money they have, they, shall we say, endear themselves, and that's a good term, to those in authority, even the ones that we place in office, and some of them endear themselves to the ones in authority through things as simple as campaign contributions. Very obvious, blatant campaign contributions. These folks, they're not dumb. They know what side their bread's buttered on, and, you know, when somebody asks for a favor, they ask for it. And they've used this mechanism over the years to come to a place where many years ago, any individual that had a Social Security number was collateralized to the Federal Reserve Bank for an amount of $1 million, their productivity against that debt from the bankruptcy going back. And to that end, they say that. And there are even some judges and elected officials that are so unbelievably clear on this that if you bring this up in court, they will try to quash what you're saying faster than you can flinch if you bring up. And there are many that are just completely ignorant, and to them, you're a conspiracy theorist or one of these individuals that's a few French fries short of a Happy Meal. There are very few out there that if you bring up these arguments in court on your own, that they will recognize it and honorably adjudicate in your behalf. Now, for those of you who recognize that there is an intelligent designer out there, this sovereign deity, whatever you want to call him, God, space aliens, ET, Yahweh, Jesus Christ, whoever, you know, he is out there. However you choose to address him or not address him, whether you want to acknowledge him or not, that doesn't change the fact that he's still out there. And he's watching. And though a man seeks an audience with a judge or a king, it's only one place where you get justice. It's from that intelligent designer. I have lived a large portion of my life as a practical physicist. There's too much evidence. I have seen too much in my few short years, too much evidence of that intelligent designer. I saw in the 70s that boat in the mountains of Ararat. I used to design DSROVs. Deep sea remote observation vehicles. I've seen images of horses, hooves, and chariot wheels in the middle of the Red Sea on the sea floor at depths of almost 1,100 feet that they are nowhere near the shore, but they're only in this middle area, and there's only one way to get there. I've been within 86 feet of the Ark of the Covenant. So anyone that wants to argue with me, I'll be happy to discuss whatever with you. It's my honor and privilege to discuss whatever with you. And amidst all of that, I've had the sheet pulled over me and the paper signed twice. I did the light at the end of the tunnel thing already. And so when I say that though a man seeks an audience with a king or a judge or, you know, a Supreme Court, it's only from the Father that he gets justice. I may have a teeny bit of background that of evidence, a preponderance of evidence that compels me to state that. And what happens is that when you go before these judges and these magistrates, bringing a compelling weight of evidence with you is something that sometimes is hard to do. And even the law enforcement officials, this surreptitious status as an indentured individual that has been collateralized, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, with specific definition in United States Code even, is not you. They believe it is. If you've corrected your status and you have this de facto evidence with you, it is very simplistic in the form of evidence from the State Department. This changes things a whole lot when you stand before a bench. But there's an old saying, it says, when you're at adversary with an individual, settle before you get to court. If you have a difficulty with a peace officer, or a peace officer pulls you out, you know, you get the blue light special, and they serve up an invitation to the circus where the ringmaster is throwing individuals to the lions. But if you get there and you're able to very tactfully and humbly, without tooting your own horn, but it says, you know, if a man sings his own praise, no one listens. A prophet's never received in his own home. But if someone else does, then it's well received. If you have to claim, well, I'm this person, and I've got this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that doesn't go very far in most people's books. But if you smile with the most abject kindness and consideration and respect for a gentleman who's stepped up with the honor and privilege of to serve them, protect and wear a badge and a firearm to serve us, if you're able to share very humbly, candidly, and succinctly with a smile on your face saying, sir, could you please look at this? This is what I've been instructed to, if I've ever been stopped, to share, to have you look at first. And let them do the investigating with the person that's going to speak for you. In this case, U.S. Department of State, the rules are very different. And you may never end up before a bench. So to that end, what I'm sharing right now is just a single aspect of what this does. We don't have enough hours in 1 week, and in 1 week there's 168 hours. And if you take out 8 hours times seven, that's 56 of that 168. That leaves you with 112 hours. I humbly and respectfully submit that in that 112, if you were to spend the whole thing with me, I couldn't begin to share all the direction that this has to offer. But you're not changing your status. All you're doing is documenting what you actually are, or correcting the documentation to what you actually are. Michael.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you so much. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to speak with John here and maybe ask a question. The part that I want to explore is not what this does for us in the future, but considering what this may do for us in the past. Some people on this call, I'm seeing names here that I recognize that I know have earlier issues, shall we call it, with the law. And since this is a correcting of a status, the Latin being nunc pro tunc, for them to change their records back to the point of the beginning, which would be when they received your birth certificate to categorize you falsely, wrongly, even though they had their evidence in their hand that you were a state citizen, that they nonetheless categorized you as a United States citizen. That's what I want to explore, how to undo what's already been done and then go for damages. That's what I'm thinking of. Our first question is Miss Jennifer from Middletown, New York.
Howdy, Judy, Michael, and John. Nice to hear from you tonight, John. I just have a
good evening, Jennifer. Sue, how are you doing?
I am great, thank you. I just have a couple of quick questions. Basically, if, like, I got the speeding ticket and I haven't heard back from them, and I had the
Let me interject for everybody on the call. The first thing that was done, the second thing that was done, was Jennifer Sue's in the process of correcting her status. She hasn't yet received any communication from the State Department, but she has her affidavits. And the second thing that she did was put her affidavit into the record, into the court case, into this traffic case. Now go ahead, Jennifer Sue.
So, is it okay to leave things like that? That seems to be open because they haven't ever sent me a date for a court date for the speeding. Because could they in the future do something? I mean, should I somehow follow up and try and get some type of a confirmation? I don't need to come to court or whatever letter from them.
Jennifer, very, very good question. You never, ever, ever, with any type of government institution, leave a matter in limbo or unclosed. We were helping a gentleman remove himself from the California 540 system, and he thought, "Wow, this is really good. Hey, I'm good to go." He got some unpleasant fan mail from California, and all of a sudden thought that everything was fine, and we kept encouraging him to continue on and finish the task. And in fact, he stopped returning calls. He inquiries. The next thing we know, a year and a half, and somewhat, how long was it? A year and a half, Michael? He contacts us and says he's got some fan mail indicating that they garnished a teeny bit of nickels out of his,
$40,000.
Out of his, pardon?
$40,000.
You know what? I'm having some trouble hearing you, Michael. Please forgive me.
$40,000, 40,000.
Yeah, $40,000, yeah. Okay, yes, that's correct. Okay, now, Jennifer, in the state of New York, the prosecutor reviews all the files after you've sent back your response like that. Sometimes the prosecutors will either set it aside for later or just not even bother with it. You'll need or they'll prosecute it. What we'll need to do is we'll make a formal inquiry. Hi, good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. Prosecutor, or good day, Mr. and Ms. Prosecutor. I haven't received any correspondence back from my letter dated such and such. I'd like to inquire what the status of this currently is. You have a moment that you could reply to me. And it'll be a very short, sweet, very respectful, and we'll make certain that you have that document in your hands to make certain that 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 matter is closed. Because sometimes, go ahead, Michael.
Oh, I just said great, because I felt like it needed, something more needed to be done.
Hey, John, there's a statute of limitations, speedy trial thing. Wouldn't it be wise to look up the date and look for what the speedy trial rule is and just wait a day or two after that before you sent the letter? Well, we lost John. He doesn't know it yet. No, his phone lasts about 20 minutes and it cuts off. Give me 1 second here. I'm going to, Jennifer, why don't you take over the helm here and just entertain people, maybe sing a song. I'll be right back.
Okay. Well, I also, by the way, I purposely sped so I could test the system. That's how I got the ticket. And I also purposefully stopped paying a credit card because I wanted to test the system with the banks. And about a year later, I got a subpoena, and we did pretty much the same thing, sent my affidavit in along with another letter. And I haven't heard back from them either, but my credit score keeps going up, which is most unusual.
All right, John has returned. We're back. And following Jennifer will be Kent.
Yeah, there's Jennifer, we never, ever, ever leave any matter with the government. Sometimes there are rare cases where they do just quietly die and go away. Actually, I'll say rare. It's the reason I say rare is because you never know. I don't want anybody to ever guess at it. It's probably about between 11 and 18% that there are follow-ups after things like that. But the problem is that 11 to 18% is something that when they bite down very, very hard. So to me, it's, you always get a follow-up saying, hey, you know what, we're dismissing this, thank you. There's with the IRS in the last 14 months now, there are 9 individuals or families or in this, we've gotten letters from them that says that we agree you're not required to file a 1040, and 4 of those we've gotten letters that says we agree neither you nor your descendants are required to file a 1040, and we made certain that all the children and their and the grandchildren have copies of those letters. You always get it documented.
Right. Well, great. So I guess I'll call you sometime this week and we can get that going.
Okay. Thank you. Sometime this coming week would probably be best for me.
But not this week, but next week? Is that what you mean?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Not a problem.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank
okay.
you. You're very kind.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Michael, who do we have next, sir?
Next is Kent. Go ahead, Kent.
Good evening, Kent.
Coming on the program and answering our questions and making your presentation. We appreciate that. I have 4 issues, possibly 3, maybe 2 of them can be combined. When Michael was talking about his concern, which we've discussed on this call before, past issues that took place, nunk-pro-tunk issues, ab initio, et cetera, is it your thinking that the people who caused this problem in the beginning, that took the birth certificate, so to speak, registered it with the State Department, et cetera, are the ones that are really at fault for the events that we got trapped in after that, where we may be entitled to damages? Or do you think that those cases should be brought against the individuals that actually caused the damage for us and let them try and cross-claim the bigger system that put them there and caused them to get into that jam. Let me ask these one at a time.
Those are very good questions. Now, may I respond with a couple of thought-provoking questions? Would that be okay?
Sure.
Okay. Let's suppose that you're one of these individuals and that you realize that many, many years ago, if you own everything, then other individuals that have breath of life in them on this earth don't have anything with which to keep the money flowing and circulating and to pay you tribute or taxes. If you happen to be one of those individuals, what happens when all of a sudden they decide to take too much and they realize that instead of letting the corn go to seed, they eat all the corn from that harvest, and then they end up losing everything. Is somebody like that going to allow an individual who grazes in his field or helps harvest or works in his field, are they going to being not just the owner of the land, but also maybe even having the judiciary on their side, et cetera, et cetera, are they going to possibly allow you to topple them?
Well, naturally, they wouldn't want that to happen.
Okay. Is it possible that they may have the nickels or that maybe a shiny dime to pay somebody to take care of an individual who might become problematic?
Obviously, yes.
Okay. Are there little people somewhere along the way that are doing the wrong, that haven't been educated, that are blindly following those instructions from over and above, you think?
Naturally.
Okay. Is there a chance to get damages tactfully at one of those levels without disturbing the large apple cart?
At the lower level, yes.
Okay. Now, the large apple cart, if they've been doing that and getting away with it, what happens with this intelligent designer? Do you think he's aware of it?
Yes.
Okay. It says, there's an old saying, it says, no man has authority in heaven or on earth except that which is established by the Father in heaven. So these folks, and it also says, a greedy man only gets money. You know, so a lot of these folks, they go to their grave only having accumulated wealth, and their children, well believing that they were doing right, though they only get wealth too, and they never suffer a moment of happiness in their whole life. They just they look at the nickels in the bank and the accounting of the shiny dimes, and they think they've done well. I know a lot of individuals that are very, very happy that don't have much. Now, the individuals in between those two groups that are facilitating and precipitating this, legitimately, if they're doing wrong, do you think it's possible to pursue them for damages?
Well, I think it would be possible to pursue either one of those parties that I was talking about, and you could look at this in various ways. I really asked you the question because I thought with your litigation experience, you would have a response in thinking about whether it's better to let, if the party on the bottom, so to speak, that directly bothered you, for them to then say, well, wait a minute, we didn't cause this overall problem. Let us go cross-claim the Big Apple cart versus attacking, so to speak?
Okay. Yes. Now you're starting. Okay, good. Okay. The little people, technically, they're the ones actually committing the crime, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. That is correct.
And they're the ones that you, so would those be the ones that you have justiciable standing to pursue and sue?
Well,
absolutely, wouldn't you?
Right,
absolutely. And,
yes.
And they working, and they're actually not just probably directly beneath them. They're a couple levels below, but to help get it corrected, when enough of them cry out, and they realize that they're doing wrong and they're being forced to do wrong, then they will push, as you so carefully pointed out, they will push it up without you having to spend the blood and the money and the risk. You ever mm-hmm. hear of a cartoonist named Gary Larson?
No.
He writes a Sunday morning funny called The Far Side. You know, it's about animals. You almost have to wonder about the sane, you know, lucidity of an individual that has nothing better to do with his time than sit up in a cabin 32 miles from the next nearest electric light bulb in Oregon and malign the poor innocent character of woodland creatures. But in one of his cartoons, he has two deer standing there in the dark in the wilderness talking. And one of them has this big white circle on his side of his midriff. Then just inside that, there's a red circle. Then just inside that, there's a white, and then a red, then a white, then a red, then a white, then a red, and a white. And the one deer says to the other, says, "Wow, Hal, bummer of a birthmark." Deer's got a target on his side. Now, if you act out in such a way that you draw fire and draw a target on your back, how far do you think you're going to get in being successful at making a difference in the long term?
Well, probably the lesser chance, the way you're describing it.
Okay. So there's going to be some tact and diplomacy required here, isn't there?
Obviously, there always is.
Yes, you're so correct. I couldn't agree with you more on that one. Are there damages to be had? Absolutely. The more quietly, the more individuals that begin to do exactly what you're suggesting, the quicker it's going to work its way like a snowball, except this snowball is going to have a lot of angry individuals in it, middle people that have gotten burnt, that have been mistreated along the way. And eventually I want you to understand something. I've been in the present when somebody said, "Look, you stupid as idiot, take the settlement. It's easier for us just to erase you, to have somebody erase you, than it is to deal with you." I've been present when that was said, and later on was carried to some unbelievable. I've actually been, I'm personally aware of individuals where that was carried to an extreme. If it's an individual, that's easy to do, but if it's a whole group, a movement, that's a lot harder to just erase or nullify that, isn't it?
It is.
And what happens if in a third or half the U.S. District Courts of the 93 that are available here in the United States, that if all of a sudden there's litigation going like this, that is going to be very, very hard to stop. And to do that, if we have individuals who have already had their status corrected, they've gotten with an information provider and they've learned what it takes to move forward, and maybe even gotten some guidance on how to plead those. And some of them, they're, you know, somebody will say, well, John, not everybody can come out, you know, with a golden dime on this one. They might get a shiny nickel out of it, but not everybody can come out with a golden dime, you know, or a $10 gold piece out of this. And I'll say you're right. On the back of a $2 bill, you'll see a likeness engraving of the individuals that signed at the Second Continental Congress that signed the Declaration of Independence. And of those individuals that were, that if we had a roll call vote there, when you check every one of those histories, you'll find that all of one of them died a pauper, but at one point they were very, very wealthy men. And they gave their lives and their fortunes. Thomas Paine said, and Benjamin Franklin, a few other folks all quoted it. It says, the tree of liberty must be refreshed with the blood of patriots and tyrants from time to time. Now, some of us, we won't do quite so good. You know, we'll probably take a beating, maybe even do some vacation time at Club Fed. But we're going to make a difference for all the people, and we're going to make it harder for the judiciary to commit the crimes at those levels. Now, there are some other things about judicial reform that we won't be able to cover on this call, but that can help make that a whole lot simpler. We're working on multiple cases right now in U.S. district courts where individuals, we have this judiciary that saying that little note about it, and then man made God in his own image doesn't even begin to apply. They have no thought or consideration for serving the people or for their fellow person that they are paid to serve and protect. If you're trying to get the dross and the impurities out of the silver, it doesn't come to the top without a little bit of heat, or a lot of it. And there's an old saying, it says, the crucible for the silver and the furnace for the gold. Now, if they had a roll call vote of those individuals that were, that are shown in that engraving, that likeness, on the back of the $2 bill, I have to ask myself every single day, would I be willing to include my name in that roll call vote?
Mm-hmm.
And so good to question. That end, yeah, yes, it is. It is. It's a very good question. And so to that end, every day I have to ask myself that. And I have to remind myself that those gentlemen and their wives and their children made sacrifice so that we could have the freedoms that we have. And a lady asking Ben Franklin as he walked away from the Second Continental Congress says, good sir, what kind of government have you given us? And he said, a republic, if you have the temerity of character to retain it. You know, people, you know, there's some of these websites and these newspapers that say democracy dies in darkness. Yeah. Where in any government document or anything for this nation does it use the word democracy? You know, the Pledge of Allegiance to the Republic for which it stands, you know, on the back of, and the front of most of our printed currency, on everything, it's the Republic. And a Republic is a government of precepts and concepts that come from biblical reckoning or God's or that intelligent designer's reckoning. A democracy is a mob rule. But it's nowhere in any document does it talk about a democracy. The Second Amendment was written at a time when they weren't worried about who could go hunting and whether you could get a 6-point or an 8-point buck. They were there because we just got done fighting a fight for freedom, and it was there to make, those weren't there to feed, well, it was, feed the families a blessing, but they were there to prevent tyranny from breaking out again. And let me ask you a question. If tyranny were to break out, and if it is already breaking it out, would it be from the people or the elected officials? Or is it from the elected officials?
Well, I guess you could say it's from the elected officials because they're the ones that are causing the people to do whatever they're doing. I think that can be open to question.
Yeah, there's so there it kind of sets a tone that we need to be very, very careful and commit our due diligence for not just our individual sake but our family's sake.
I like your response, and I can tell that you put thought into, you know, what you do and how you do it, and you see the bigger picture. I think part of the problem, or at least my experience with getting people to settle, is they eventually invest so much in the project of trying to settle with somebody or going through all these court procedures, and they get so disgusted that they, you know, they want that big shiny gold dime that you were talking about, and they fail to recognize that if they really look back and think about the situation, that they may have been, you know, it's hard to admit, but that they may have been part of the problem, and therefore they don't want to settle. So I think people need to put a lot of thought into these things, just like you're talking about, and not just jump the gun. The other comment I would make about what you said is that it's been my principle throughout life is basically when there's a problem with somebody, to start at the bottom and not take it right to the top. And I've received a lot of criticism and assisting of people over the course of time for operating the way I do. However, I found it's the most efficient way to operate, to give the person that's actually, so to speak, quote-unquote bothering you, the opportunity to fix it and at least collect evidence if you do have to take it on the way up.
You know what? My observations support your perspective there.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask Mike. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I have respect for your perspective. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to ask the second question. I don't know primarily what arguments you were using, be they one by one or whatever, prior to the point where more recently people are correcting their status. But I would like to know. Bernie has spoken on a couple of occasions. He hasn't said much about it, but he certainly indicated that he does not believe that the whole job has been completed with the correction of status papers. And if anybody disagrees here with what I'm saying or I've misinterpreted what he's saying, I'll stand corrected. But he indicates that he went further back in the late 1990s with the revocation of signatures, power of attorney, et cetera. And he used different terms. I think he used three different terms to cover three separate issues. Was that primarily what you were doing, or do you think before the correction of status came along, or do you think that what Bernie is saying really is valid and there's more that needs to be done after this administrative process? And then after that, I have one final question.
Back in 1995, Bernie and I and a few others, we met at a little hotel in Scottsdale, Arizona, and there was a young gentleman there that was working on correcting status back then that and at the time, we discovered that correcting your status is not the end-all to end-all panacea. And to describe that, marriage is not a destination, it's a journey. And it's having a good marriage is like running a race. you know, the fact that you're running that 440 and you're running like a tortured slave to stay ahead of the competition, and, you know, and the fact that you're winning is a function of the fact that you're running like a tortured slave to stay ahead of the competition, you know. If all of a sudden you throw up your hands and say, look, I'm winning, whoosh, the crowd just passed you by. There are individuals that would seek to re-enslave you no matter what you do, how you do it. And right now, this correct your status is something, this is like running that race with sandals versus some very nice running shoes that taking a $6 pair of sandals and taking it off and putting on a very expensive couple hundred dollar or maybe $1,000 pair of running shoes. This is something to, it's a vehicle to help you go through all of the other trials, etc., and help you in this race. There is, I would have to agree with Bernie, with Justice Breshears. He, there are other things that need to be done. They, in my few short 60 some odd years, I'm not quite 70 yet, thankfully. I used to talk about 50 people in their 50s being elderly. I don't seem to do that anymore. I would have to agree with Justice Breshears and indicate that while this is an extremely necessary step, it's not the last one. Does that answer your question?
I guess it does. So would the last one be along the line of the revocation of prior signatures, power of attorney, et cetera, would that be your thinking as far as being more
those,
final steps?
The more entanglements that you have created in the few short years that you walk through life, the more you have to go back and untangle yourself from. And if you've got entanglements that, Justice Breshears has a very elegant way of covering some of those entanglements. I've never actually, even in a weekend seminar, heard him, or a week-long seminar, I've never actually heard him cover even half of the potential entanglements that individuals can get themselves into. But there are entanglements that involve your signature, and be absolutely certain that he is one of he's one of the few living people that I recognize as having the background that he does to help people with the strength and the accuracy and with candor and sincerity of anybody I know. He's extremely wise. And he's very aware of, even every time I chat with him and we cover that subject, I learn something new on that topic. All of us through life have created some entanglements that, some of them, a lot of them once you find out about them, you wish you'd never gone there, but when you did go there, it was in ignorance. So, there's this is not the stopping place. This is a huge starting place with correcting your status.
Well, I also asked the question I'll make it short, Mike. I also asked the question because Bernie, being kind of a purist, if you will, says that, you know, it's just better to stay away from Social Security. So even though you're correcting your status here administratively, he still doesn't like the idea that, you know, at least as far as he's concerned, that one would collect Social Security because he feels that's an entanglement, so to speak.
Well, now, you sound like you're probably over 23, so you probably remember the days when, and I'll use a term that Bernie only usually uses in private, but calls it socialist insecurity. I've been able to collect for, I may have been able to collect for a year or two or more. I have not. Through my life, even when I was unemployed as a young man in the 70s after I got out of the Air Force and I was temporarily unemployed, I and could collect unemployment, I never did. It was always my desire to contribute to the public trust, but never take from the public trust. And to that end, it's my desire to always give. In fact, even when many years ago, when I was employed in the regular captive workforce, I always had more taxes taken out than I needed to. I was always giving to the public trust. Now, to me, income tax is optional. It's voluntary, I can give you the arguments to prove it, and I can make it very, very simple. Do the judiciary like that? No. Have we maybe got a few people, more than maybe one or two or more, free from the entanglements of that? Go ahead.
Allow me to interject on this. Kirk, Kent, it's a two-step process. And the reason for it is because the majority of people that I talk to are not involved in any preparation for what we call a global currency reset or an RV. And that for those people who are not independently wealthy, then correcting your status is the first and the last place you're going to go. And it's going to be great. However, there are those that will become independently wealthy if and when the global currency reset takes place. And when it does, they're going to go from being to wherever they are to being multimillionaires, in some cases, billionaires. At that point, there will be absolutely zero need to be having any relationship whatsoever with the United States. So what Bernie has is a process by which you rescind your signatures on a number of different documents that these specific documents that you rescind over the years is what entraps you wholly and totally within the system. So what you're doing on the first part is correcting your status, but on the second part you're saying adios. Because no one has, you have a choice. You can be a citizen of one of the states, and that's it. You can be a citizen of one of the states, and you can also be a United States citizen. You can be both. Or thirdly, you can be only a United States citizen. So what you're doing by correcting your status is that you are really coming into the first and part of the second, where you're still enjoying your privileges, if you would, because you're contracted and paid into them. But after you become wealthy beyond measure, then you don't even need that. Don't bother with it. Just go back to rescinding your signature from everything. And that's in a nutshell what it is. Anything else?
Okay,
Ken?
Thank you. Yeah, I have one more question,
right,
but let other people go, and then if you have time at the end, you can come back to me, okay?
Okay. I'll leave your mic open and leave you there. The other gentleman that was there, I took off. So I have
John,
a question back from Freedoms Radio. I have a question over on Freedoms Radio. Sorry?
I said I want to thank John for answering my questions and his comments.
Sure.
An honor and a privilege, Ken.
Thank you.
Okay. Murphy over on Freedoms Radio writes in that he provided for a part-time employer, if you want to call him that. As a worker, he filed a W-8 BEN, and they refused to stop removing, taking away part of his pay and giving it to the government. Now, there's an individual who is directly writing the checks, and that individual is following orders from the chief financial officer of the company. And he's asking, can I sue the fellow, the individual, who is taking a portion of my labor and giving it to somebody else without due process? And can you help me with that? That was the question.
Well, this is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, which begs the question, who's the one in authority here? Is it the people or is it the IRS? And the IRS then made God in their own image. But nonetheless, the employers are required by law to manage as you submit. And if you claim this amount of dependents or that amount of dependents or whatever, or you want extra taken out or less taken out, it's you who's responsible in the end for balancing the books or the sheet. And if you if you're responsible for filing a 1040, it's you that's responsible for meeting that that responsibility, the accuracy, and the withholding. Okay. Now, when you file that, your responsibility is to them is to identify how you're filing. Okay. So what happens is at this juncture, if the employer is usurping their own or the IRS authority and yours, what happens is that they're out on a limb all on their own. And at that juncture, they're no longer coloring between the lines, as it were. So at this juncture, one thing I'd like to bring up is 26 U.S.C. 7203. That's 26 U.S.C. 7203. And the employer, what I do is I recommend printing a copy of this out, and you can get it off of Cornell Law. It's very just 26 U.S.C. 7203, and it says willful failure to file a return or supply information or pay tax. And the first three words in that are any person required. So it's clearly indicating that there are individuals that are not required. It says any person required under this title to pay any estimated tax or tax required by this title. Okay. So what happens is that an individual can supply to their employer that they are not required to file a 1040 or pay tax. And whether they do that in the form of a letter of an interoffice memo or an ANVO or they file a W-8-B-E-N, the employer is now immediately subject to, in this situation right here, criminal prosecution. To say that somebody is required to file or pay tax and they are not is a federal crime. And under 42 U.S.C. 1983, that's 42 United States Code, USC, 1983, an individual can sue them for civil damages for claiming that they're required to withhold, et cetera, and that they're not required. Now, there's something that's very, very important. There's a delicate nuance that you have to be very aware of. And this is a landmine. It's a huge bear trap. It's a man trap. And it's very, very important. Individual employers will say, well, if we took out too much, just file your 1040 at the end and get it back. Okay? Well, what happens is that, first of all, they illegally and wrongfully took out what you see. It is not their discretion, it's yours, which you have withheld against the debt that you know you may potentially have. Now, when the IRS has made assessments, do they know how many dependents you have? Do they know how many toll booth receipts you have, or how many lunch or dinner receipts that were business expenses? Do they know about all of your charitable contribution, other deductions? No. And they make an assessment. What we do is we send a letter saying, thank you, we received your correspondence dated such and such, form letter such and such, signed by this person. And at this juncture, substantial errors in your accounting. And to that end, we would like you to provide copies of all the assessments and the materials that individuals that you provided to them for making these assessments, and the individuals make assessments, and certification by the individuals making those assessments. Now, back in the 90s, and back in 1997, a lady from Bishop, California, on her income tax return, pointed out that she lost $56,700 to a scam, and the IRS disallowed it, you know, as a loss, you know. And what happened was is we quietly I wrote the letter for the lady, and she submitted it. And unbeknownst to me, all of a sudden, all the prosecution, everything stopped. The lady let me know almost a year later that I said, what happened on that? She says, it stopped and went away, and I got my thing this year, and I already filed, and they got it back, and there was no et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, it wouldn't be till I was fighting a habeas corpus case in Utah, and I was visiting an inmate at the Utah State Hospital there in Provo, and I thought, I'm going to amble over to the IRS, you know, and, you know, to the Provo. And I ambled over there, and I asked the lady, I says, you know, we've got a thing here. I just wanted to get on this account, and here's my power of attorney from this individual, and I need a form of assessments and everything, et cetera. And I used that exact verbiage. And she got real stark face, poker face, looked at me, both headlights run bright, and she began writing on a piece of paper in front of me upside down, please meet me in the parking act next to the big light blue Rambler station wagon. You know, but she's saying, sir, I'm sorry, we can't help you with that. And she's saying, sir, we don't entertain requests like that. Sorry, we can't help you. You'll have to leave now. But she's writing, meet me in the parking lot next to the Blue Rambler at the far southwest corner in 5 minutes. And she's writing this down. And I didn't realize there were cameras and microphones in there and the whole thing. So I went out there, and she says, sir, back in 1997, somebody wrote a letter like that, and we started to provide the thing. And we found out that when we were certifying it, we were committing perjury. There's no way that we could possibly know what all those individual deductions were. And so that all of us that were writing all those things, we were told that if anybody ever asked for this, not to provide anything, but to stop the prosecution immediately. I says, really? And I says, you know, in 97? She says, yeah, there's some lady from Bishop, California. And she said the city. You know, and I couldn't believe it, you know, and she described the circumstances, and I realized that I was the one that wrote the letter, you know, but there was individuals. What you can do is you can ask, and this is the best way to handle a situation like this. Ask the person that's denying or that's ignoring the W-8-B-E-N, just say, you know, I noticed that you're withholding and you're now in exact opposition to my W-8-B-E-N. Could you please define what chapter, paragraph, and verse of the United States Code of Chapter 26 that you're ignoring my certified signed document that's in evidence and see how they respond. If you need help with that, get a hold of Michael. We'll see what we can do to help you.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. Well, that concludes the questions that we have tonight, except for Kent. He had one more, and then we'll close with that and go home.
Okay, John, what I wanted to ask you is, and taking into consideration what Mike added at the end of what you were responding to me regarding a two-step process, but the fact that some people only want a one-step process, as Mike is aware, I am considering doing the correction of status, if you will, through a court process rather than the administrative process. Thinking that a court process is more of a final order, and if the court is properly set in a common law status, I then have a right to that order that can't be challenged by anybody in this fictitious overlay. Could you make, if you follow exactly what I'm saying, could you make some comments on that as how you view the administrative process versus a court process? Taking into consideration that not everybody would want to go through a court process to accomplish this.
That's an absolutely beautiful question, Kent. And you know what? There's may I respond to your question by asking a couple of questions?
Go ahead.
If you have an administrative process that you can go through A, B, C, that establishes precedent without the potential conflict or an adversarial environment, do you think it's wiser to get that first before you go to court or after?
Well, I guess when you put it that way, it would be wiser to go through the administrative process first, and then if you were somebody like me who thought that administrative process resided within the legislative overlay, then you might decide to go for the process with the 1802 Naturalization Act through the court system.
Okay. Now, do you have, now, when you go into court, what's that thing that they always ask? You have to make a plea for which relief can be granted. You ever heard that
Correct.
Before?
Correct.
Okay. So that means, so I guess that means, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that you must have what they call justiciable standing to make that pleading, correct?
Well, I would think if I was able to set up a common law court, I would be able to do that. Now, I understand
okay.
there could be an argument. I understand, but I should preface it by saying I understand there could be an argument, but you don't have that court order yet, and you're at this present time, based on how you've conducted your life or your parents started your life out with a Social Security number, et cetera, you're part of their system, so therefore you don't have that standing to go do that. I can see that argument come down the pike.
You know, you made a comment about started your life out. So are you saying you, very early on, with all knowledge and cognizance of all the facts, made a contractual agreement when you were 5 or 6 or years old or 5 or 6 months old, having all the facts and evidence, you made a cognizant decision to enter into a contract with the government for Social Security?
Obviously,
is that what you're telling me?
No, obviously I didn't
okay,
do that.
Okay.
I don't.
Oh,
I don't
so somebody else did it for you. So
right,
you're somebody else did it for you. That so when you came of age, in a lot of states it's 18, some it's, there's a couple it's 21, but and all of a sudden you find out that somebody else made decisions for you that you didn't have a chance to make, and you can, you know, if you wanted to, you wanted to get that socialist insecurity number and the account and all the related fetters and entanglements removed. And I know some people that have done it and gone through that way. But if you wanted to get that removed, you could just say, hey, look, somebody else did this contract. I'm over 18 now. I'm not mentally disabled and otherwise able to make decisions. And at this juncture, that contract is not what I would have made. And so at this time, I challenge the contract and rescind any participation and signatures that were involved in that. And heretofore, with ask the government to cease my socialist insecurity account. Now, a government who keeps track of people and paperwork, are they going to just take a number and erase it when they've got all this data in the files that go with it?
Likely not, but had I been smart enough to do that when I was 18 or 21, I likely wouldn't be on this call.
Yeah, but do you think they would have just taken all of your paperwork that includes deposits and payments that might have been made many, many years ago, that if something happened and your account was ever reopened and you demanded that, or you had a court case where you demanded those monies back, would they keep the evidence so that they could say, wait a minute, he's asking for $8 back, he only paid us $5, and so that they only have to pay $5 back? Or you think the government's going to discard all of that and all the data and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? 40, 50 years ago, you think they would have done that?
No, I would expect they would have kept it as evidence. Now, whether they would have continued to use
right.
it against you depending on what you had done, I don't know.
Yeah, and now in the information age, when nothing ever goes away ever again, because there's so many redundant servers that even if you crash these, there are others that are optically coupled that there's no easy way to crash, that data, you think, if there was ever an account number possibly assigned to you, do you think it's ever, ever, ever going to go away?
Very doubtful, very doubtful.
Very doubtful, yeah. So correcting your status, correcting the status in the computer or on file with the State Department is very important. Now, if you can do it for... Now, if you're going to engage in a legal process, you know, and you do it on your own, you're probably looking at $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 minimum, you know, of your own time. And if you hire outside help, and some of the folks that I was at law with back in the 70s, they charge $275 an hour. Some of them charge $400. I know one individual charges $4.65 an hour. You know, that's his flat rate time, you know. And he bills on the 10th every 6 minutes. And we had two professors that ground our bones with that, you know, bill on the 10th. And the other thing they ground our bones about was conflict equals cash. When there's a disagreement or conflict, that's what cash is. And that's how they make their living. But if you're going to, you know, if you're going to hire an attorney to help you with this, or a law firm, there's probably going to be quite a few shiny nickels to get your status corrected. But so if you do the administrative route, which do you think would be cheaper, the administrative or the legal to go first?
Well, I would handle the legal myself with the assistance of a couple people that we would work together on this. So I don't really see it being that expensive. But I do get your points about it being adversarial, about they may not want to give me such a court order. They may try to drag it out. I mean, there's 100 scenarios that could come down the pike. Likely I haven't thought of all of them. I also see an issue where by me making an application through the courts, even if it's a common law court, to do a certain thing, that may set in the record a date certain for which I couldn't go back beyond that time, as I could do with an administrative process, as we talked about before. So, you know, there's pros and cons that all have to be weighed out, in, you know, before one takes
now, can
you
I,
know, either one of these actions.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
If you go into court and you already have an administrative status correction, are they more likely to try to buck that or go against it or go in concert with something that the State Department already applied and then give you your court order without a battle?
Well, that's a very good point. They may be inclined to go in concert with that.
I'd have to agree with your observation.
Right.
I'd have to agree with you on that one.
I did think, however, if they wanted to diminish or stop me from getting such a court order, that they would then say, well, wait a minute, you have this administratively, and we're not going to interfere with this. So, therefore, you know, administratively, legislatively, you have it. And, you know, they'll come up with some BOCO reason not to move the court case ahead. I mean, like I said, there's all kinds of scenarios that could take place here. You know, I mean, this is not something that we've got 20 people have gone down the pike on it and done it, so we can pretty well estimate what's going to happen. I, you know, we can guess what's going to happen, but, you know.
If I had a humble suggestion and I was in your case, oh, wait a minute, I've been in your case before. Oh, wait a minute, I even tried doing that. I might suggest that doing the administrative first. There may be a teeny weeny bit of wisdom in doing the administrator first, and then when you have an issue where you have justiciable standing and you're able to bring it into court, and you have a claim for which relief can be granted, and you can get a court order that is supported by your already corrected status, so that you can have that affirmed. And if you really need the court order, and, you know, which always begs the question, why are we looking for a court order when someone else can overrule a court order as well?
Mm-hmm.
Another bench, a higher bench, can overrule it. There's an old saying, it goes, if it works, why try to fix it or don't fix it? If the administrative does work, it may be wise to consider not ending up in a bummer of a birthmark hell moment where you end up, if you think in your skills and your skill set, it's been an honor and privilege meeting you this evening, and I feel like I know a little bit about you, but in truth, I don't really know you from Adam. Now, you may have some magnificent courtroom skills, and you may, you know, have studied meeting objections, and you may have multiple law degrees and do very well in court, or you may go in there unskillfully, overlooking one single item, and get a ruling against you that cavalierly and callously and insensitively rules and weighs against everybody else that has already got their status corrected and now puts a threat, something that never needed to be a threat, and you yourself didn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see the point there?
Well, that's a good point, but I do think going in under the naturalization law of 1802, I don't really see how that would adversely, again, I get your point, but I don't see how that would adversely affect somebody who's gone for an administrative correction of status with the State Department. I mean, I may be wrong about that, but
I watched a situation only a couple weeks ago, actually it was a couple months ago, where somebody sitting on a jury, and then subsequently the judge, who didn't have his coffee that morning, ruled in a manner that would have curled your toenails. And the bailiff commented, she says, I've never heard the judge rule like that ever before. And maybe he didn't have his coffee that morning, maybe whatever, but it was completely contrary to law, wisdom, and good sense. So if you want to take something that can be an all-in-all-the auction, free, all-in, all-done, by just going the lock-knee-step monkey motion process without putting the things at that risk. I don't go into court if I don't have to, and I encourage people to stay away from it. If you, you know, have some little thing up your sleeve where you know you can get a ruling and a judgment, okay, that's one thing. But I've come to realize there were individuals that there was an argument that we were using with the IRS, and somebody decided that he was going to try to sell this proposal to other people, and he took copies of portions of the brief that we filed and was selling it, and he changed enough that he called it his own and that it wasn't technically plagiarizing what we had already done, and he was somebody that likes to claim that it's his own, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I've now come in contact with four individuals. The three of them are now incarcerated because they missed or left out some critical portion of it unskillfully, and they ended up, rather than getting relief that they should have gotten relief at an administrative level before it got to court, but they decided that they were bold enough that they wanted to just go into court and get the et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, when every single case where we've gotten a letter, we got it outside of court, and they ruled upon it. They settled. The prosecutor and the Treasury Department settled out of court for every single time we got the letter. These guys felt ballsy enough to go into court, and now three of the settlements that we've already got are being called into question in the cases where we were actually in court, because these guys unskillfully pled their case, got ruled against, and then appealed, and it went up to the appellate court, and one is in the third, and one is in the seventh, or two in the seventh, actually. And now the Justice Department is reopening two cases that we already had ruled upon 4 years ago, where the people, they're appealing it on new evidence, and they're using these judgments against them that were unskillfully done in other cases, and they were all on the brief that I wrote. So if you would expect me to support you going into court first, I would humbly submit, not no way, not no how, not this century, not in any lifetime. Our children saw that we gave at the office. Don't let them call us. We will call them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you make a good point that, another court can overrule another court, another bench. So.
Yeah. Kind of a nuisance, isn't that, how that works? But the thing is that not stirring up any unnecessary litigation that could produce a controversial judgment that could weigh against us is not an act of skillful discretion, in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's my personal thought.
Gentlemen, it's a late hour. It's a bewitching hour. And I want to thank you, Kent, for your insightful questions. They always are good. Appreciate you. I want to thank Brother John here for coming on tonight. It was a spontaneous thought, and I'm very grateful that he did. And I think this was answering one of your wishes and fishes from a few weeks ago that we have someone here to talk in addition to me. So here you are.
Thank you.
Maybe he'll even appear again sometime soon. Who knows? So I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight, and see you next week, Saturday, with Judge Bernie about how to protect your assets by actually giving them away. You protect them by giving them away, but controlling everything as it moves forward in time. And then Monday, return with GW, and we'll cover more details about that 15-minute interview. Until then, I want to thank everybody. Good night. Thank John, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Thank you.